Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Eleonora Matiach. Today, I'm here with Harris Mylonas and Maya Tudors, authors of the book Varieties of Nationalism. The book was published in 2023 by Cambridge University Press in their Elements in the Politics of Development series. Welcome.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about yourselves.
Harris?
I'll start. I'm Harris Mylonas, or Mylonas, as we said, a political scientist. I work on nation building, and more generally, I work on how states manage diversity. And I'm an associate professor at George Washington University and an editor-in-chief of Nationalities Papers.
And I'm Maya Tudor. I'm also a political scientist, and I work on questions of democracy and, of course, nationalism now and how the two actually relate to each other. And I have a regional focus on South Asia, but I'm sort of also work comparatively around other regions of the world. I'm an associate professor of politics and public policy at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. And actually, as of recently, I'm an editor of this series, this Politics of Development series.
Congratulations. That's great. Tell us a little bit more, or tell us why you decided to write this book.
Well, I can start. I think we should start from the very first story we have in the book. In a way, Maya and I were trying to explain to each other why we think such a book is needed. And we came to this Buddhist text that we start with, where a group of blind men heard that a strange animal called the elephant was coming to town. But none of them were aware of its shape and form, and they all came to different conclusions about how it looks like based on their experience with it. And we, you know, at least I felt that the political science and social sciences in general had approached nationalism in so many diverse, interesting and diverse ways, but the final result had often been a similar experience where people are holding really tightly a part of the elephant called nationalism, but failing to see the whole or failing to create more cumulative understandings while respecting the differences that definitely exist. So I think, for my part at least, that was a good way to communicate what I feel was happening. And I think Maya and I went back and forth, and the product is the book. Yeah. But I don't know, Maya may have I would be very interested in seeing how Maya sees this, because I'm not sure I know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I largely agree with that. I came, you know, Harris is an old hand at nationalism. He is an editor of Nationalities Papers. But I came to nationalism not actually having spent any time on the topic other than, you know, a little bit of a class in graduate school. And I was struck when I began to read around the topic, you know, of course, we're living in a time of rising nationalism, that even within the field of political science, there was so little in the way of agreement on what it meant, you know, how it related to ethnicity and to religion and how you, and that has all kinds of implications for how we study nationalism and how we talk about it in politics and in the public sphere. So, you know, I thought, okay, well, how do we think about this? And we then wrote an article together, and a lot of people said to us, gosh, that was so useful, that article, and kind of spelling out what we know already about nationalism and what we don't actually know. And that led us to think about, okay, well, if you were to take forward a research agenda on nationalism, and we really need that right now in a way that we haven't needed it for decades, how would you think about the different ways in which we study nationalism? And that was really the motivation to write this book, to get scholars to talk to each other about how we study nationalism and the questions that we don't yet have answers to.
That's great to hear. I love the metaphor of the elephant, quite literally the elephant in the room. And
yeah.
I agree with what people told you, that a piece like this was much needed, and it's very helpful. So tell us what's the argument? What's the argument in the book?
The argument is that that nationalism is a political ideology, but it's also fundamentally associated with a search for sovereignty. So if it's an identity or ideology that doesn't seek sovereignty, it's not nationalism definitionally. So, and that's important because there are things that are not nationalism, because it's a pretty broad tent. The argument is that there are kind of a couple, there are five ways in which nationalism differs, and that leads to, or that there are three questions which can lead you to essentially five dimensions. And those dimensions are, you know, the first question is, does a nation exist, right? And there are times and places where that's a question. So because either elites are fragmented and aren't clear, they aren't cohesive about the idea of the nation, and the popular sectors, the public, isn't united around the ideas of the nation. And sometimes the popular sectors and the elites are united, but they have different views from each other. So that we've also talked about research that looks at those kinds of cases. So the first question you have to ask yourself is, does a nation exist? And that leads to kind of two varieties or two ways in which nationalism differs, which is elite fragmentation and popular fragmentation. A second question you ask is, you know, how do the nations or the national narratives that exist, how do they vary? And they can vary with something we call ascriptiveness and thickness. And in really brief terms, ascriptiveness is in the social context that you're looking at nationalism, is the nation fixed? Is the national identity fixed, or can you choose to become a member of that nation? And so, you know, we can say, well, look, you know, if you have a religious definition of the nation, then that means the nation is fixed. But actually, in some contexts and places, you can choose your religion, and some places you can't. So it's very much whether something is ascriptive is very much contextual. So that leads to a third dimension, which is ascriptiveness. And then a fourth dimension is thickness. So how many things can you say define the national identity, right? So, you know, you might be able to talk about, you know, in Scotland, let's say, you know, haggis and, you know, the poetry of Burns. And, you know, you might talk about lots of elements that make the nation thick, that define the nation. And in other contexts, you know, Ethiopia is a good example, where there isn't actually that much in the way of shared markers of belonging. So, you know, how thick is the national identity is a fourth. And the third question leads to the fifth dimension or variety of nationalism. And that is, when do national narratives or nationalisms matter? And we all can kind of intuitively guess at times of World Cup victories or at, you know, times of the Olympics, that your national identity relative to other identities rises. But, you know, at other times and in other contexts, local and other identities take precedence. So it's really about the fifth dimension is about the salience of national identity and how top of mind is one's national identity relative to other national identities. So again, that's the main argument of the book is that there are these five ways in which nationalisms vary and that scholars should really be trying to speak to each other by trying to identify what elements of nationalism they're working on. I'll just say one more thing, which is this has become totally commonplace among democracy scholars. You would not see a book about democracy or an article about democracy that didn't first talk about what definition of democracy the scholar is adopting. And yet somehow this is not at all common practice among nationalism scholars. So if there's a thing that I think that Harris and I would love to see come out of this book is that nationalism scholars, in an attempt to build a more a vein of scholarship where we're all speaking to each other and where knowledge is accumulating, that we are speaking in terms of this is my definition of nationalism and here's the ways in which I'm understanding nationalism such that we can actually begin to have cumulative conversations.
I saw you made that point about democracy and the concept of democracy early on in the book, and I found myself nodding. I thought, yeah, that made a lot of sense. So this five-dimension definition of nationalism, what kind of evidence do you use to make this point that these are the dimensions we should pay attention to?
Well, let me add as a link to the previous conversation and the answer to this question. I think we're doing more than just present this framework, which, of course, you know, Maya presented very well. But I think the book, maybe implicitly or at the second level, is also doing other things that are not as explicitly advertised, let's say, in the beginning. And you can tell us whether we did it successfully, Eleonora, because you read it. So, for example, it's quite contested in the literature, perhaps maybe only the nationalism studies literature, but there is definitely contestation about whether nationalism is necessarily linked to what Maya called descriptive characteristics or markers. And we explicitly take a position that nationalism may, but doesn't necessarily have to be linked to ethnicity or ascriptive markers. In other words, we believe that nationalism is not essentially linked to ethnicity. In this sense, we de-link once and for all, let's say, nationalism with ethnicity. That is not something that others have not said, but it's usually said in a little bit more esoteric way or within a case study and so on and so forth. It's rarely stated up front in a theoretical exposition or discussion about nationalism. And we take a pretty clear stance. And I think in a not very controversial way, I'm not saying it's necessarily controversial, but we make it very clear and we make it a central point. The second thing that I think the book is doing, again, not necessarily very explicitly, but it does do that, is that we're saying we understand that everything that has to do with nationalism is historically contextual, right? But that doesn't mean that we cannot engage in comparisons across cases, right? And that links to your discussion with Maya earlier about how democratization has moved on, right, from these type of debates. Democratization experiences are also contextual. It's not like they're not, right? But people have moved on from this discussion because they have developed frameworks to do that. And we hope that the framework that Maya just presented is at least a way, not the only way, but a way to move forward and have these historically contextual, but also multidimensional discussions about nationalism that respect the uniqueness of its cases history and development, but does not render it apples and oranges kind of in the minds of people. It allows it to be part of a general comparison or a general discussion at the very least. Now, given what we just said, of course, our evidence to make this point come primarily from our own empirical work. Maya has done a lot of empirical work in the past, in the case of India and beyond India as well. I've done mainly work on the Balkans, but also beyond the Balkans. And then we built on I think we already alluded to that, we built on a really strong and long history of case studies and individual, let's say, findings, which we try to synthesize both in our annual review piece, but also in the Varieties of Nationalism book. So it's a mix of our own in-depth work in particular cases and secondary case studies that we have built on, or even statistical analysis we've built on by synthesizing basically a lot of these findings.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son?
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This is great. So what I hear you saying is that these five dimensions sort of should inform conversations on nationalism going forward and allow for scholars to sort of engage in conversations, in fruitful conversations with others to study nationalism. Am I hearing you? Yes. That's great. Tell us a little bit more then about how the book is organized.
I think in a way Maya has already kind of described it. So Maya, it's better if you just link back to what you already said, right?
Yeah. So the book is organized by an introductory chapter, which just lays out much of what we've already been talking about. I think it begins with the question of why do we need another book on nationalism, right? Don't we have enough? And it lays out the case that actually we need another book on nationalism because we don't have a book that integrates how different scholars have looked at nationalism and the ways in which they're not speaking to each other. And that means essentially that you're not stepping on the shoulders of one another to accumulate knowledge. And then we talk about, we introduce the framework, and then we, in each of the subsequent chapters, develop with respect to case studies or cases that we know well, but also the work of other scholars who've done work, very in-depth historical work, but that in ways that we bring their research in from many regions of the world to, for example, look at, you know, how do we think about elite fragmentation versus popular fragmentation? So an example of this is there's a Ram Herr's recent work in which she compares Taiwan and Korea very closely and shows that actually elites and kind of popular sectors are very united on their vision of the nation in Korea, but they're quite disparate in their vision of the nation in Taiwan, and then goes on to talk about all the ways in which that impacts policy and the politics of these two countries. And so we draw on her work as well as our own expertise in shedding light through both examples, but also conceptually on what we mean by this dimension. And then we sort of conclude by talking about the ways in which we hope nationalism research will build on these dimensions so that we can talk to one another and build a conversation about a kind of a modern ideology that we know is rising in importance in the politics of our time.
Great. Thank you for offering this overview. I want to ask you about the conclusions of the book, but I think you told us already. So let me ask you some questions more in depth.
I can add something to the conclusions,
please.
Because I think in a way it is also part of the reason why we wrote the book. So I kind of undersold our initial interaction with Maya 5 years ago, I think we met. And from the very beginning, Maya was always interested in the question of the consequences of nationalism. And in the process, we also both realized how little we know about how national narratives change. And the combination of those two questions is clear in our conclusions that we think more work can be done. There also multidisciplinary work. And we're currently also, both of us, engaged in different projects that are related to these questions. So in a way, you could say our conclusions are a recapitulation of everything we already said, as you rightly realized, Eleonora, and you were about to move on rightly, but also a call for research, more research on these questions, very central questions that have been quite neglected given how much work there is in nationalism, and have been neglected primarily because of such an emphasis on the origins of nationalism. The question of origins has been very central, for better or for worse. It's not up to us to judge that, but it is a fact. To the detriment of these other questions, in a way. Yeah.
You mentioned the multidisciplinary aspect of the research on nationalism. This is something the book does very well. It just offers a rich and extensive review of the literature, but not just in political science, but across a broad array of disciplines, ranging from history to evolutionary biology. And as I was reading, I had a question. Do you think that the debate on nationalism, does it correlate across disciplines at all, or does it not? Or does it correlate at some points in time, but not others? What was your sense from reading through these fields?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And it got me to think a little bit about this. And I one of the ways in which the disciplines actually do correlate is that, you know, nationalism wasn't a really big topic of study until sort of the start, the close of the last century, and the beginning, or the close of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And at that time, you know, because you just had a really much broader array of political organizational forms than the nation state. And they were beginning to be crowded out, right, as the 20th century dawned. And so nationalism began to just be studied more as a topic in general, and that correlates across the disciplines. But interestingly, and patriotism, which is many people, I think is a positive, you know, all the good things about nationalism, that began to decline. The word patriotism in its frequency in books began to decline. And nationalism takes over patriotism in terms of frequency, according to a kind of Google Books and Google Scholar criteria, around the time of the Second World War. And that's not a coincidence, right? So we're, of course, much of our research is driven by observing the world around us, and people who were writing about nationalism, as they were in large numbers after World War II, largely abhorred nationalism as something to be discarded, left behind. But, you know, that was a little bit of a pipe dream, because we live in a world, and certainly did after World War II, of almost uniformly nation states. And the identity of nationalism and the, you know, it when you invoke nationalism, when political leaders invoke nationalism, they're legitimating the use of state power, right? It's why when, you know, we saw COVID lockdowns, you saw political leaders standing in front of their peoples with a flag in the background, often invoking nationalism in some shape, and then asking people to make sacrifices, right? So there's a clear link here between nationalism and the use of state power. And at the time of World War II and its aftermath, people, especially in Europe and the United States, where scholarship, you know, has largely emanated on the issue, although thankfully this is changing, that, you know, they really felt uncomfortable with this idea of nationalism. But I think that that has led to a real normative slant on the word nationalism. And no scholar that I know of, serious scholar of nationalism, really takes this distinction between nationalism and patriotism to be a serious or stable empirical distinction. That actually, if you are strongly attached to your nation and you think good things about it, but not necessarily bad things about other nations, that under circumstances of threat, of war, even at football games, right, that those distinctions, that kind of negative othering is always always a possibility for nationalism. So that's some of the ways in which I think nationalism studies have been quite similar across time. And it's really relatively recently, as Harris already said, that we've begun to see a shift away from understanding the origins of nationalism to its consequences. And that's also something that you've seen kind of quite consistently across the disciplines. Of course, they differ as well. And I think that, you know, social psychology tends to look more at the kind of micro situational and contextual changes around nationalism, whereas, you know, sociology tends to look at the, you know, long cultural markers, and there's lots of other disciplinary approaches. So I won't belabor those, but I think those are some of the themes. And it's really helpful to understand that historical context, because I think it's incumbent upon us scholars not to come too much with those normative priors, to understand that nationalism isn't always good or isn't always bad, but that it's a part of our political landscape, like states, and that we're not living in a world anytime soon that is free of nation states. So we need to do our job in understanding the ways in which nationalisms differ and the consequences of those differences.
This was great. This was great. Thank you. Indeed, we should be aware of our priors. I like that a lot. So tell us a little bit about where you would like research on nationalism to go. So what I mean by that is that, you know, the book is foundational in that you provide scholars with new conceptual tools to think about nationalism. How would you like research on nationalism to change after this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that has been at the center of what Maya and I have been trying to do with the book. And that's why it has this nature that it has. On the one hand, I think the framework that we just described here in the podcast, but also in the book, allows scholars to automatically, so to speak, situate their work relatively to other scholars and other types of research questions. On the other hand, it allows scholars to think of what, for lack of a better term, non-slang political science term, scope conditions, right? To think of where their argument is applicable and forces scholars to think about where their case, if they're studying one case, falls in the global distribution of cases, right? Because not all cases are the same. At each point in time, somebody could use our dimensions to describe a country's variety of nationalism by assigning values, for example, for each one of these dimensions that Maya talked about, the five dimensions she talked about. And that's going to allow someone situating nationalism around these dimensions can allow them to then start identifying similarities and differences across cases or with different cases, and thus understanding where this case falls in the global distribution of cases. So, for example, two countries may be considered to have similar nationalisms because they are equally ascriptive or because they have equally thick national narratives and so on and so forth, but they may have differences in their fragmentation and so on and so forth, right? So these are important comparative tools, let's say, that we hope people will take away from here. Relatedly, there are policy implications of these values that each country gets, for example. So we do explicitly say in our conclusion, for example, that more ascriptive understandings of nationhood are ceteris paribus, more likely to discriminate against the inclusion of immigrants or refugees, for example, relatively to less ascriptive ones. And so you can also start formulating hypotheses along those dimensions that we talked about and based on those values. So it's a two-pronged attack, both a methodological and epistemological, let's say, breaking those barriers for cumulative knowledge or comparisons, and breaking this idea that because nationalism is historically contextual, as we said, and multidimensional, we cannot study it systematically, right? We try to go beyond that to the extent possible. Again, that's never perfect, even the democratization literature. And then at the same time also, it's a very good way to generate new hypotheses in a way. So I'll stop there. Yeah.
I agree. I agree with you completely. I think I want to move on into the world, from the world of studies to the world of, I don't know what we want to call it, practice, policy, current events. And I want to ask you about immigration, because societies across the world are grappling with the issue of immigration more and more. What is the role of nationalism in navigating the current debate on who should be allowed to become a citizen and who shouldn't?
So I think that's a just enormously important question. If you think about how societies have addressed kind of all of their major problems, right? And if you think about even the big problems that we think lie before us today, whether it's climate change or whether it's inequality, to solve those problems, you need collective action. And you need collective action given the world that we live in at the level of nation states, right? Where sovereignty resides. So you need nation states to say, we're going to cut our carbon emissions, or we're going to come up with new regulations for how people are allowed to emit and such like. And you can do that only if you have a strong collective sense of the we. So as societies diversify through immigration, those questions become harder. And there's a kind of excellent research to back this up, right? That to the extent that you think the nation doesn't represent me, you're less likely to sacrifice for the nation. We actually saw this. Actually, there's some really interesting research that shows people who were more identified more strongly with the nation were more likely to take pro-social actions during the time of the COVID pandemic, right? So they were more likely to wear masks, stay home when their government asked them to, right? So there's a link between the sense of the we and how you identify with it and how you can actually, in practice, solve social problems. And immigration is one of those ones that almost all societies are grappling with in some shape or form. And as societies diversify and you have immigrants coming in from other parts of the world, you need to have a strong sense and a clear sense of who is the we and a pathway for those immigrants to identify with the we. And we know that some countries do this better than others. So, for example, we cite a study actually in the book which talks about the Canadian Chinese, or Chinese Canadian, and Dutch, Chinese Dutch. And right, immigrants that have come to these two countries, and they're asked by, I think it's a social psychology study in which they're asked kind of, who is your significant other, right? So who is your out-group in a sense? And Canadian Chinese, or Chinese Canadian, however you want to say them, their most significant out-group are the real Chinese, right? So whereas in the Netherlands, for the Chinese Dutch, the most significant outgroup is the real Dutch. And so what that shows you is in the case of the Netherlands, for whatever reason, Chinese immigrants don't feel as integrated into society and as genuinely Dutch as Chinese Canadians do. So, you know, Canada is doing something right in terms of providing kind of the raw ideational material that allows immigrants to feel as though they're genuinely a part of the society that they have immigrated to. And I think we all need to be learning from examples such as Canada. So understanding what countries like Canada are getting right about immigration is a really important question. And for that, we need to have shared vocabulary about what nationalism even is.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
No matter what you're looking for in a non-alcoholic beer, there's only one name that has it all. Athletic Brewing Co. Full flavor? It's athletic. Huge variety? It's athletic. Award-winning styles you can get online, at the bar, or the grocery store? It's athletic. In fact, when it comes to amazing non-alcoholic beer, there's no question. It's athletic. Ask for it and find out. Go to askforathletic.com to find your closest retailer today. Near beer.
That was great to end with this this collective sense of the we. You kind of anticipated my next question a little bit, but I want to ask it anyways to see if you want to add something. You know, right at the beginning of the book, in the intro on page one, you argue, quote, nationalism is the most powerful political ideology of the modern age, end quote. As we said today, you then go on to explain that nationalism varies across five crucial dimensions or categories, and that nationalism can look quite different depending on how it scores on these five dimensions. And so if we think about the current global context, you know, recurring wars, interventions in wars, nuclear proliferation, massive migration, as we just said, and so on, with phenomena that are truly like collective and global. What type of nationalism can be a force for good?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, Maya's previous answer also highlighted how our book is also limited in its ambition as well, right? Because some of the things he highlighted rightly go beyond the scope of what we have identified as dimensions. Maybe the most relevant to the examples he gave is how the Canadian national narrative is different from the Dutch one. But again, that's not enough to capture what Maya articulated. So that I want to show that we're humble enough to recognize in our own presentation of our book that, you know, there's a lot to be done beyond our book. But to get to your more specific question, we have discussed this with Maya many times, and we each have our own views on the topic. We haven't written a normative book, obviously, here. But there is no doubt in my mind that ideally humans would solve their collective action problems globally, right? And would demonstrate solidarity at the global level. However, this, as you very well pointed out in your question, I think, does not look imminent. It doesn't look like this is about to happen. And in the meantime, I think both Maya and I agree that nationalism as an ideology could be a force that could help us solve these important collective action problems that we have and lead to solidarity that is manifesting itself beyond the immediate family or kin group, right? It's easier to show solidarity in your family context. Again, not always, not all families are equally solidaire, but regardless, in general, let's say. But what other ideology makes you be solidaire and solve collective actions effectively at the larger scale? Maybe religion in some cases has been tried, but nationalism is undoubtedly right now the social force that is used to solve collective action problems, descriptively speaking, at least, beyond the moral question, and to elicit solidarity, right? So the question we, I think, try to pivot to with Maya in this book, implicitly and explicitly at times, is what can we have a type of nationalism that does not denigrate others, as you already mentioned? Is that a program that is possible, despite the fact that under certain conditions, every identity, as Maya alluded to earlier, could have these tendencies? Can we have types of nationalism or types of national narratives, if you want to become more specific, right? The second question that is key for our framework. Can we have such national narratives? I believe that we can, but again, that's a debate to be had. And the question is, beyond that, when you have those national narratives, can they be sustained and can they fight against the other ones, the narratives that are more exclusionary, the narratives that we are continuously discussing these days because of what has been seen as the new nationalism or the far-right nationalism or nativism nationalism that is on the rise in various places, which seems to be more popular than what I've called this more this nationalism that is not denigrating others and is delinked from these super ascriptive characteristics that necessarily exclude others, right? So again, our book is not a normative book, but we do have sprinkles of these ideas here and there.
That is great. And I think I've taken up enough of your time. I'll ask one final question. What are you working on right now?
I'm working on my next book project, which relates the question of nationalism to democracy. And I'm looking at, in particular, the question of language and how language is, first of all, a very important defining characteristic of a nation as it emerges and the decisions around language, but how that often, can set up internal exclusions and inclusions that are very, very consequential, particularly, in the parts of the world where most people live, which are post-colonial states. I mean, that's and how ideas of nation can be more conducive to democracy in the long term.
That's great, Harris.
Yeah, and I'm very happy that Maya is working on this. It's a very necessary space to make progress on for our understanding. I work on several projects that are related to nationalism and nation building, ongoing projects, let's say. But I'm my sort of newest thing, although by now it's quite old, is my focus on kind of nation building abroad. So I've been working on nation building within the country, but now I'm working more on how states view their diasporas and how they manage them, a term that I've often been criticized that I'm using. But I do think that states often think of their diasporas, unfortunately or not, as assets. So I call it diaspora management logics. And I'm trying to identify those logics that governments have vis-a-vis different discrete segments of their global diaspora. So I unpack those, and I don't talk about the diaspora policy of a country, but rather logics that governments have vis-a-vis different segments. Yeah,
those are great projects. I do hope you come back and tell us all about them.
Thank you so much. You're on record now, so you have to have us.
We'll be back.
Thank you so much for talking to us today. My guests have been Harris Mylonas and Maya Tudors, authors of the book Varieties of Nationalism,
This book was published in 2023 by Cambridge University Press in their Elements in the Politics of Development series. I am your host, Eleonora Mattiacci. Until next time.